Welcome to Between the Lines, listening to literature on life. This is show number 146, Some True History. Part 2. Once again, reading from Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's An Indigenous People's History of the United States, published by Beacon Press. And the more I get into this book, the more I'm liking learning about it. It's fascinating stuff. Sometimes history seems like just rattling off facts and dates, but as she gets into the book, she ties together some themes and start to get a perspective of really of global history. So some of that gets revealed in this part two. As mentioned in part one, some of the stuff is really quite relevant to what's going on with the campaign trail, and so that opens up a whole topic of conversations amongst peoples who want to do that. This is your host, Monk. Thank you for listening. We are outdoors for another episode, starting off with Chapter 6, The Last of the Mohicans and Andrew Jackson's White Republic. In 1803, the Jefferson administration, without consulting any affected indigenous nation, purchased the Louisiana Territory from Napoleon Bonaparte. Louisiana comprised 828,000 square miles, and its addiction doubled the size of the U.S. The territory encompassed all or part of multiple indigenous nations, including the Sioux, Cheyenne, Arapaho, Crow, Pawnee, Osage, and Comanche, among other peoples of the Bison. It also included the area that would soon be designated Indian Territory, Oklahoma, the site of relocation of indigenous peoples from west of the Mississippi. 15 future states would emerge from the taking, all of present-day Arkansas, Missouri, Iowa, Oklahoma, Kansas, and Nebraska, Minnesota, west of the Mississippi, most of North and South Dakota, northeastern New Mexico, and North Texas, the portions of Montana, Wyoming, and Colorado east of the Continental Divide, and Louisiana west of the Mississippi River, including the city of New Orleans. So anytime I hear the word Louisiana purchase, I say something, because it wasn't a purchase. Well, on the books, it might have been a purchase. And let's see, here's a section, subsection into this chapter, career building through genocide. Neither superior technology nor an overwhelming number of settlers made up the mainspring of the birth of the United States or the spread of its power over the entire world. Rather, the chief cause was the colonialist settler states' willingness to eliminate whole civilizations of people in order to possess their land. This trend of extermination became common in the 20th century as the United States seized military and economic control of the world, capping 500 years of European colonialism and imperialism. The canny Prussian Otto von Bismarck, founder and first chancellor, 1871-90, of the German Empire, was prescient in observing, quote, "The colonization of North America has been the decisive fact of the modern world," end quote. Jefferson was its architect. Andrew Jackson was the implementer of the final solution for the indigenous peoples east of the Mississippi. And she goes on to describe some of Jackson's background. In 1801, that Jackson first took command of the Tennessee militia as a colonel and began his Indian killing military career. It was in 1881 that Jackson did that. After his brutal war of annihilation against the Muscogee Nation, Jackson continued building his national military and political career by tackling the resistant Seminoles in what are known as the Seminole Wars. So this goes on and on. And another section here talking about and again, a reminder who defaces the $20 bill. The same guy. Let's see, a guy named Hawkins. Trying to find the. And then, due to two decades of diligent work on the part of U.S. Indian agent Benjamin Hawkins, he was in charge of the U.S. government's, quote, civilization, end quote, project, lending the settler moniker Five Civilized Tribes to describe the great agricultural nations of the Southeast. Hawkins' mission was to instill Euro-American values and practices in indigenous peoples, including the profit motive, privatization of property, debt, accumulation of wealth by a few, and slavery, allowing settlers to gain the land and assimilate the Muscogees. At the time of independence, hundreds of settlers were squatting illegally on lands of Muscogees of the Lower Creek towns, and that is where Hawkins concentrated, leaving the Muscogees upriver alone. However, traditionalists among the Upper Creeks who had allied with Tecumseh and the Shawnee Confederation understood that they would be next. As they saw the 20-year Hawkins project transforming some citizens of the Lower Creek towns into wealthy plantation and slave owners while the majority became landless and poor. And this is just, you know, right there, a blueprint for what is going on today and is now spread globally. And most notable is, you know, sometimes people question if things are deliberate or just happened to be this or happened to be that, and there it says, to instill values such as including the profit motive, privatization of property, et cetera, et cetera. These are things I've read about recently as you know, coming out of the Chicago, I think it's the Chicago School of Economics, Milton Friedman, and you know, Harvard, and various places where the view of the world and of economics and the model of business is you know, part of the official curriculum. And again, this is from what I have read of about that. I haven't studied the syllabus, curriculum, what have you. And just, I guess the thing I find astounding over and over in this is that the mentions of the some of the horrible stuff that it just, it's to see how that in some way stuff hasn't changed. I mean, I think, you know, we're in a time when more people are aware, and the media and the social media gadgets are helping to make a positive change. So here's an example. In a series of search and destroy missions over 3 months prior to the final assault on the Red Sticks, Jackson's mercenaries killed hundreds of Muscogee civilians, pursuing without mercy even homeless and starved refugees seeking shelter and safety. And later on, she writes, the Muscogee War thus inscribed a U.S. policy of ethnic cleansing onto an entire indigenous population. The policy originated by Andrew Jackson in that war would be reconfirmed politically when he became president in 1828. Maybe you can hear the lovely woodpecker. Here's a quote. Armed occupation was the true way of settling a conquered country, Senator Thomas Hart Benton of Missouri said at the time, reflecting a popular blend of militarism and white supremacist Christian identity. The children of Israel entered the Promised Land with implements of husbandry in one hand and the weapons of war in the other. The United States annexed Florida as a territory in 1819, opening it to the Anglo-American settlement. In 1821, Jackson was appointed military commander of Florida Territory. The Seminoles never sued for peace, were never conquered, and never signed a treaty with the U.S., and although some were rounded up and sent in 1832 to Oklahoma, where they were given a land base, the Seminole Nation has never ceased to exist in the Everglades. In 1824, the first permanent U.S. colonial institution was established, first named the Office of Indian Affairs and placed tellingly within the Department of War. Whereas white supremacy had been the working rationalization for British theft of indigenous lands and for European enslavement of Africans, the bid for independence by what became the U.S. of A was more problematic. Democracy, equality, and equal rights did not fit well with dominance of one race by another, much less with genocide, settler colonialism, and empire. It was during the 1820s, the beginning of the era of Jacksonian settler democracy, that the unique U.S. origin myth evolved, reconciling rhetoric with reality. Novelist James Fenimore Cooper was among its initial scribes. That's where the Last of the Mohican story comes in. And, you know, fascinating, that whole sort of, I guess it's still playing out, this sort of schizoid mindset of the phrase, oxymoronic, settler democracy. Now here's where it gets into some sacred cows of the literary fields, and I'm not saying this is the full presentation or a comment on all of their writings, but I'm just going by what she mentions here. Herman Melville called Cooper, the author of The Last of the Mohicans, our national novelist. Cooper was the wealthy son of a U.S. congressman, a land speculator who built Cooperstown, named after himself, in upstate New York, where he grew up. His hometown was christened All-American with the establishment of the National Baseball Hall of Fame in 1936. Cooper devised a fictional counterpoint of celebration to the dark underbelly of the new American nation, the birth of something new and wondrous, literally the U.S.-American race, a new people born of the merger of the best of both worlds, the native and the European, not biological merger, but something more ephemeral, involving the dissolving of the Indian. In the novel, Cooper has the last of the, quote, noble and, quote, pure and, quote, natives die off, as nature would have it, with the last Mohican, handing the continent over to Hawkeye, the nativized settler, his adopted son. This convenient fantasy could be seen as quaint at best if it were not for its deadly staying power. Cooper had much to do with creating the U.S. origin myth, to which generations of historians have dedicated themselves, fortifying what historian Francis Jennings has described as, quote, exclusion from the process of formation of American society and culture. So, it's fascinating to see how the literary, I guess, you know, in its way, the media propaganda of its day. All right, sound check, 1, 2, now we're inside. Here's a quote, let's see, from U.S. exceptionalism weaves through much of the literature produced in the U.S., not only the writing of historians. Although Wallace Stegner decried the devastation wrought by imperialism on indigenous peoples and the land, he reinforced the idea of U.S. uniqueness by reducing colonization to a twist of fate that produced some charming characteristics. Ever since Daniel Boone took his first excursion over Cumberland Gap, Americans have been wanderers. With a continent to take over and manifest destiny to goad us, we could not have avoided being footloose. This reader put BS in the side notes. And it continues, the initial act of emigration from Europe, an act of extreme deliberate disaffiliation, was the beginning of a national habit. It should not be denied either that being footloose has always exhilarated us. It is associated in our minds with escape from history and oppression and law and irksome obligations with absolute freedom, and the road has always led west. Our folk heroes and our archetypical literary figures accurately reflect that side of us. Leatherstocking, Huckleberry Finn, the narrator of Moby Dick, all are orphans and wanderers. Any of them could say, call me Ishmael. The Lone Ranger has no dwelling place except the saddle. So, yeah, that's quite telling. Quite telling in, as far as following that forward to, what's his face? Jack Kerouac's On the Road, this whole archetype of America and on the road and traveling, and how many car commercials have you seen where they're driving through rugged country? And so this fascinating look at some of the origins of this, you know, sort of origin myth, as it's called, because it's, you know, it's like, what are the Euro settlers escaping from? And so it really ties in with the whole coming to terms with the whole Turtle Island true mythology. And here we have again the British novelist and critic D.H. Lawrence, who lived in northern New Mexico for 2 years, conceptualized the U.S. origin myth, invoking Cooper's frontiersman character Deerslayer. Quote, you have here the myth of the essential white America. All the other stuff, the love, the democracy, the floundering into lust, is a sort of byplay. The essential American soul is hard, isolated, stoic, and a killer. It has never melted. Daniel Boone, an icon of U.S. settler colonialism. And this end of this section, a comment on, yet the leather stockings' positive twist on genocidal colonialism was based on the reality of invasion, squatting, attacking, and colonizing of the indigenous nations. Neither Filson nor Cooper created that reality. Rather, they created the narratives that captured the experience and imagination of the Anglo-American settler stories that were surely instrumental in nullifying guilt related to genocide and set the pattern of narrative for future U.S. writers, poets, and historians. That's very telling, and I, as a writer and poet, especially one who lives with the Whitman country, Long Island, it's a fascinating topic to this day. And here Dunbar Tease sums it up nicely, or not so nicely. Every year, state and national democratic organizations hold fundraising events they call Jefferson Jackson Dinners. They understand that Thomas Jefferson was the thinker and Jackson the doer in forging populist democracy for full participation in the fruits of colonialism based on the opportunity available to Anglo settlers. It's not that Jackson had a dark side, as his apologists rationalize, and which all human beings have, but rather that Jackson was the dark knight in the formation of the United States as a colonialist imperialist democracy, a dynamic formation that continues to constitute the core of U.S. patriotism. The most revered presidents, Jefferson, Jackson, Lincoln, Wilson, both Roosevelts, Truman, Kennedy, Reagan, Clinton, Obama, have each advanced populist imperialism while gradually increasing inclusion of other groups beyond the core of descendants of old settlers into the ruling mythology. All the presidents after Jackson march in his footsteps. Consciously or not, they refer back to him what is acceptable, how to reconcile democracy and genocide, and characterize it as freedom for the people. Setting the pattern of the dance between poor and rich U.S. Americans ever since under the guise of equality of opportunity. And Jacksonian democracy from 1824 to 1852. So quite a telling bit then, and this is having me see the coming to this country, which you know many have done. If you have ancestors coming over from Europe or wherever, you know, many of us are like that, and so it's just now I'm seeing this as like a form of assimilation. So on the one hand, you have the better, the people that come over here for better life, better conditions, better life opportunities, in that sense, a positive sort of quote, land of the free, and yet they are indoctrinated into this sort of storyline, and the whole the native Turtle Island angle is not typically at all part of that indoctrination. So you have a kind of freeness dash assimilation. So it's again a mixed bag, and it's fascinating how the era that she's describing with Jackson is sort of promoting that sort of populist imperialism, which just sounds so oxymoronic. And another example of gold, let's see, while the case was working its way through the courts, gold was discovered in Georgia in 1829, which quickly brought some 40,000 eager gold seekers to run roughshod over Cherokee land, squatting, looting, killing, and destroying fields and game parks. Under authority granted by the Indian Removal Act, passed by Congress in 1830, the United States drew up a treaty that would cede all Cherokee lands to the government in exchange for land in Indian territory. The U.S. government held Cherokee leaders in jail and closed their printing press during negotiations with a few hand-picked Cherokees who provided the bogus signatures Jackson needed as a cover for forced removal. So that's one on Jackson's record there, the Indian Removal Act of 1830, which I am not sure, but it sure seems connected to the finding of gold in 1829, that then the Indian Removal Act of 1830. And after the Indian Removal Act 1838, the well-known Cherokee Nation forced march known as the Trail of Tears. And then in the north, especially in New England, some states had illegally taken land and created guardian systems and small reservations, such as those of the Penobscots and Passamaquoddies in Maine, both of which won lawsuits against the states and attained federal acknowledgement during the militant movements of the 1970s. Many other native nations have been able to increase their land bases. Jackson was an actor who made possible the implementation of the imperialist project of the independent U.S., but he was also an exponent of the Euro-American popular will that favored imperialism and the virtually free land it provided them. And to show how the rhetoric gets extended, here is a here she cites 21st century as patriotic cant, a civic religion invoked in Barack Obama's presidential inaugural address in 2009. He said, in reaffirming the greatness of our nation, we understand that greatness is never a given. It must be earned. Our journey has never been one of shortcuts or settling for less. Blah, blah, blah. It has been the risk takers, the doers, the makers of things who have carried us up the long, rugged path towards prosperity and freedom. For us, they packed up their few worldly possessions and traveled across oceans in search of a new life. For us, they toiled in sweatshops and settled west, endured the lash of the whip and plowed the hard earth. For us, they fought and died in places like Concord and Gettysburg, Normandy and Quezon. Time and time again, these men and women struggled and sanctified and worked till their hands were raw so that we might have a better life. This is the journey we continue today. So, again, it's like, yeah, if you have relatives who did that, you respect whatever they struggled with to get here and to work and et cetera. And yet, on the other hand, there's the other part of that picture, which is what the land was already and still is. And as Dunbar Ortiz says, spoken like a true descendant of old settlers. That says it best. And she ends this chapter with quoting Obama again. We sometimes make mistakes. We have not been perfect. But if you look at the track record, as you say, America was not born as a colonial power. And Dunbar Ortiz, the last sentence of the chapter, the affirmation of democracy requires the denial of colonialism, but denying it does not make it go away. In the next chapter, 7C to Shining Sea. Now I'm remembering at one point a poem that I found Extremely inspiring. The Whitman's song of the, I think it's Song of the Open Road. Afoot and lighthearted, I take to the open road. It's, you know, very upbeat, joyous, whatever. It starts off that way. I forget the whole context, but maybe it has some changes in it, but it sort of, it reflects to me now some of that footloose and fancy free that this chapter begins. It's a side of Whitman that had not realized or had been subtly aware of through his writings, but having been enamored with him early on, I still appreciate the poetry, but it's cast in a new light with some of this stuff here. The populist poet of Jacksonian democracy, Walt Whitman, sang the song of manhood in the Anglo-American super race that had been steeled through empire, STEEL. As an enthusiastic supporter of the U.S. war against Mexico in 1946, Whitman proposed the stationing of 60,000 U.S. troops in Mexico in order to establish a regime change there whose efficiency and permanency shall be guaranteed by the United States. This will bring out enterprise, open the way for manufacturers and commerce into which the immense dead capital of the country, Mexico, will find its way. Last part's a quote, but, you know, Whitman did in his later years. He was, after the Civil War affected him, so his view on war changed, and he has a whole poetry section about that. He was there nursing the wounded, so, you know, he obviously had his compassionate side. Meanwhile, Whitman explicitly grounded this prescription in racism. The nigger, like the Indian, will be eliminated. It is the law of the races, history. A superior grade of rats come, and then all the minor rats are cleared out. Yuck. The whole world would benefit from U.S. expansionism. Quote, we pant to see our country and its rule far-reaching. What has miserable, inefficient Mexico to do with the great mission of peopling the new world with a noble race? So there's the nonsense of the superior elitist stuff. And, you know, that some say, well, that was a reflection of the times. And yes, it was. But again, the key thing to me in this whole thing is this, what she calls the U.S. origin myth, that had the frontier settlers replacing the native peoples as historical destiny, adding its own theoretical twist of what would later be called social Darwinism, because it takes seeing some of this origin myth to sort of deprogram nowadays and, you know, catch up with what's going on. And she mentions Haiti as the first permanently successful national liberation movement against European colonialism in the world. That's a whole another sector of history there. She mentions Simón Bolívar, a major leader of the independence movement in South America. That's playing out now with the Bolivarian Revolution in Latin America. Another interesting bit here I learned was the military connection. Like the Lewis and Clark expedition completed the same year that Pike set off, the Pike expedition was a military project ordered by Jefferson. So we get these sort of these explorers in an innocuous way, but to see the connection with the military sheds new light, sheds new darkness on it. Another key phrase here: in the U.S. system, unique among colonial powers, land became the most important exchange commodity for the accumulation of capital and building of the national treasury. To understand the genocidal polity of the U.S. government, the centrality of land sales in building the economic base of the U.S. wealth and power must be seen. And so, again, must be taken into account the Turtle Island, and then how this, again, is contrasts the native people's way of living with the land. And the pueblos, the New Mexican pueblos, a thriving irrigation-based agriculture supporting a population living in 98 interrelated city-states, pueblos. Now it was whittled down to 19, I think it is now. And that's a chapter of Spain and Mexico and the Franciscans. And basically, it's a beautiful, beautiful area that I have visited, and these like adobe churches that are beautiful, and yet a lot of them have the crosses. So a lot of the pueblos, in a smart way, took on some of the religious trappings in order to save their save them, you know, no pun intended, to save themselves and save their cult, preserve their culture. And then so that, yeah, that's another whole study of how much of that, how many of those people have been sort of Christianized from that, and how many have maintained their traditional ways. And again, gold, as mentioned in another, the other show, the San Francisco 49ers, here she has, she quotes as Alejandro Murguia, however you pronounce his name, describes it, unlike the native people for whom gold was irrelevant or having, you know, a spiritual level of relevance, the 49ers, quote, hungered for gold with a sickness, end quote. And here's a section called The White Man's Burden. The two-year invasion and occupation of Mexico was a joyful experience for most U.S. citizens, as evidenced by Walt Whitman's populist poetry. Its popularity was possible because of buoyant nationalism, and the war itself accelerated the spirit of nationalism and confirmed the manifest destiny in the U.S. Besides new weapons of war and productive capacity brought about by the emerging industrial revolution, there was also an advance in printing and publishing techniques, which increased the book publishing market from 2.5 million in 1830 to 12.5 million in 1850. Most of the books published during the five-year period leading up to, during, and after the invasion were warmongering tracts. European-American settlers were nearly all literate, and this was the period of the foundational American literature, with writers James Fenimore Cooper, Walt Whitman, Edgar Allan Poe, John Greenleaf Whittier, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, James Russell Lowell, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, Nashville Hawthorne, and Herman Melville, all active, each of whom remains read, revered, and studied in the 21st century as national and nationalist writers, not as colonialists. Although some of the writers, like Melville and Longfellow, paid little attention to the war, most of the others either fiercely supported it or opposed it. Whitman, a supporter, was also enamored of the violent Indian and Mexican killing Texas Rangers. Whitman saw the war as bolstering U.S. self-respect and believed that a true American would be unable to resist this pride in our victorious armies. Emerson opposed the war as he did all wars. His opposition to the Mexican War was based, however, not just on his pacifism, but also on his belief that the Mexican race would poison Anglo-Americans through contact, the heart of darkness fear. Emerson supported territorial expansion at any cost, but would have preferred it take place without war. So this is fascinating, being one who, you know, sort of grown up a bit on the wisdoms and the teachings and the examples of Emerson and Thoreau. And again, this is not a thorough study, no pun intended, not a thorough study, but there are positives from their literature, and yet here it is from an indigenous people's perspective. You have to take this into account and see it from their angle to get a wider a picture. And another quite telling line here: however, even the abolitionists believe in the manifest destiny of the English race, as Lowell put it in 1859, to occupy this whole continent and to display there that practical understanding in matters of government and colonization which no other race has given such proof of possessing since the Romans. So again, it's just quite amazing to see this sort of, you know, populist imperialism on, you know, on the one hand supporting certain open-minded things, and on the other hand this just, you know, flat out biased supremacist angle of manifest destiny. So that about wraps up that's like two chapters. Thought it might get more, but that's okay. So it's looking like a three or probably four parts. And just to wrap up with her last it's a long paragraph. Part of the last paragraph here. The 1st and 2nd of U.S. Army Dragoons cavalry troops were employed for this purpose. Elite mounted troops well equipped and trained for the desert terrain. During the period between the Mexican War and the Civil War, indigenous resistance was led by Gila Apache leader Mangas Coloradas to maintain the Apache's traditional lands and way of life. The Dragoons employed the first way of war, total war, encouraging field units to attack Apache villages and destroy crops and kill livestock, slaughtering women and children and old men left in the villages while the young men were engaged elsewhere fighting the Dragoons. This kind of warfare against indigenous people continued throughout the Civil War and ratcheted up in the northern plains and Southwest afterward, producing the term that the U.S. military to this day, all over the world, when referring, uses to this military used to this day all over the world when referring to enemy territory, quote, Indian country, end quote. And that's the next phrase, the next chapter titled, quote, Indian country. And I think, you know, she mentions Vietnam. And so that whole, the whole psychology that has come from, again, is fascinating to see the sort of line from the old world empire and belligerence coming over to Turtle Island, and then that then going back out the other way to further expand this, you know, the global corporate empire of today, today's world, and to see how some of the verbiage and the metaphors are sort of the ongoing storyline, so to speak, the sort of guidelines, and that gets played out a lot. It's just some of the U.S. military hardware, whether it's Apache, you know, from Apache helicopter, Apache whatever they're called, some kind of planes called Apaches, to the innocuous Cherokee Jeep. But you know, imagine you are a Cherokee, and you know, you see that on the road. I mean, there's an offense to that. So anyway, that's it for this part two, and thank you for listening. And we'll go out with a track off of the album, of the CD, KSA, K-S-A, by Ghost Horse. This is called Comfort Wana. Comfort, and then the second word is W-A-N-A.